Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the Week in Horror Front Row. I am your host, JL, and with me tonight is an amazing guest. We have writer, film writer, director, actor, man of multi-talents, Jeremy Ashley. Thank you so much for being here tonight. We do appreciate you hanging out with us.
You are too kind, JL. You are too kind. I don't do a whole lot of on-screen acting, but I do do voice acting, as you can probably tell from the very deep baritone voice which I have. I do voice acting. You do voice acting as well, right?
I do. Yes, I do.
Nice. Anything in particular? Do you do like trailers, explainer videos?
I used to live back in I lived in Texas for 30 years before I moved up here to Oklahoma. And when I was down there, and I did work for Funimation for about 5 years. So I did a ton of Walla and a ton of additional voices for various animes across the board. My most predominant work was done in One Piece. I had a few voiced characters that were in that one. So I had that going on and a couple of other ones. But One Piece was where I did most of my work. And then things kind of like went haywire when the pandemic hit. And so it was kind of like, because people couldn't come in into the studio and people had to record at home and send it in. So it was just, it got crazy. But about 5 years, I worked a lot with Funimation. That was a lot of fun. I love voice work, in my opinion. And I think you may agree. In my opinion, as a classically trained actor, trained on the stage, I feel that voice acting is literally acting in its purest form, because all you have is your voice and you have the image on the screen. But when you're in the booth, you give your entire body to that in order to convey everything that you normally would with the full tool when you're on stage, when you have your blocking and all that stuff, or when you have the nuances. When you're on screen, you got a big extreme close-up. It's all in the eyes and the mouth and the micro-expressions.
Right. Yeah.
All of that has to be conveyed via just your voice.
Yeah, you got to act it out in the studio.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Literally moving around.
You could just be like, you could do whatever to get the energy up and convey all this. And I got a reputation for being very animated in the studio, especially, doing fight scenes or something like that. I'd be like all over the place. And everybody's look out for JL.
Move some stuff around.
I loved voice acting because it's so free. There's no audience, and you could just throw your whole self into it. I loved it. And I saw your reel. Yeah, you have a collection of your voice work on your YouTube channel. So
you
I checked that out.
Research. Oh man, you just went, a you little went deep. Just a little. Okay, no, that's good. No, I appreciate that.
Just enough so I don't come off like a stalker is what it is.
No, I mean that's important. You know, when you're interviewing anybody, you got to do a little research on it. That's why I went back and watched some episodes of your podcast. Obviously, I watched the one with Russell, which was one of the newer ones that you put out recently. Russell, who was our casting director in Meat Hook, this movie right there we're going to talk about. He also starred a part. He played a couple parts in it, actually, including the role of the killer in a couple scenes where we don't see his face. So had a chance to check out the podcast. Really awesome show that you put together here. Really love it. You seem like you do a great job as a host. So thank you for having me here today.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, it's funny because did Russell tell you how he and I met?
It was through the Faces of Horror thing, right?
Faces of Horror contest.
You guys were both in it, and then you guys ended up getting knocked out, and then some girl ended up winning and doing the Buffalo Bill House and Kane Hodder and all that stuff. And then now they're doing it again, right?
They are. And so it's funny because Russell actually, we started like chatting back and forth via Facebook. And then at one point I was doing a live stream where I was doing my promotion thing, come vote for me and stuff. Just the usual thing. Totally. He popped into a live stream and started chatting back and forth with me. I thought that was hilarious. So we built up this rapport, and then we moved from there.
Oh, yeah.
I'm kind of curious. Face of Horror. You know, I understand the setup, but what do you think of that way of utilizing something like that in order to fund a project? What's your take?
Obviously, I know that as independent filmmakers, it's very hard to raise money at all. So utilizing crowdfunding sources such as GoFundMe or Seed and Spark, which is what we use for Meat Hook as a fundraising campaign platform, is kind of a necessity. Now, coming up with new and inventive ways in order to have perks for people in order to raise money, I thought that obviously a lot of people got into the Faces of Horror thing. A lot of people really gave their all to try and win the contest and were hitting people up every day. I know Russell was very serious about winning it. And even got like a cameo from Kane Hodder, shouting him out in it, which was really cool. I don't know. I mean, I haven't did the contest myself, so I can't really speak from firsthand experience. But as a way of raising money from a producer's standpoint, it is a very inventive way to do it. Now, I don't know how much money they ended up raising. Obviously, they had some that went to charity as well, right? Like, right, that was part of the whole deal, is that some of it went to charity and it was for a good cause. So that's obviously a really good aspect that they introduced into it as well, other than just keeping all the funds. I don't know. I never seen any of these guys' movies, so I'm not really sure, you know, how they run things or how it works. But it does seem like a very competitive contest, obviously. Right. And I don't know. A lot of it is very much popularity based as well. Like, it's not necessarily like you're the face of horror, like you're the biggest fucking horror fan, or, you know, you start in all these horror movies or whatever. You know, it's kind of just who can get to vote for you as much as possible day by day. So in terms of that, it's not really representative of what the contest is about in terms of face of horror. So I think it's a little maybe misrepresented in those ways. I don't know. What are your thoughts on it? How do you feel about it being actually in the contest yourself?
So, definitely when it got down there, because I made it to the semifinals before I got bumped out. And right, my whole take on it was that it's definitely a pay to win. So if, like, if you intend to win, you definitely got to get people to spend money. And right, that was the big thing. I was glad that 25% of everything they took in went to the B+ Foundation. That was good. Totally. So that kind of, like, you know, it was like, okay, that's really awesome. They're doing something nice there. Yeah. But, you know, as far as like, I by the end of it, I was kind of like, it's kind of gimmicky. It was kind of like no different than on Indiegogo or any other kind of like crowdfunding deal where you spend a certain amount of money, you get a particular perk that goes along with it. So right, if someone was willing to dump $20,000 into, or have people dump 20 grand into this thing, then they get to go meet Kane Hodder and do a photo shoot. I was like, it's pretty much the exact same way. And then the guy who was running the whole thing pretty much was like, yep, this is how we're going to raise money for this. So all we have to do is like secure these things. So all you get, so right, I get the model, but it's pretty much just a crowdsourcing model. Right. My problem was, the only thing I saw was that there seemed to be very little oversight. Whereas with Indiegogo or with Kickstarter or any others, there's a lot of oversight when it comes down to those things and a lot of fact checking and what's going on behind the scenes. Whereas this one seemed very loose with that. Whereas all the oversight was coming from them. So then I think that because of the appeal of like Kane Hodder and everything, it drew people in. But but looking at it from now that they're doing a second round, I'm seeing a lot of people like, this is not worth it. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. You got to spend so much money. And if you're not willing to spend that, there's no point in giving any money at all. Right. And, you know, because the film that they said they were going to make hasn't been made yet. Mm. Now, they say it was because of the pandemic, which I'm inclined to take their word on that. This is the pandemic kind of hit and it was like they got delayed. That's fine.
Reasonable.
But where did the money go? Yeah, is the whole big thing, you know. It's like, it's kind of like, so now if that money never did, if that money just, now they're doing it again, where's that money going? And so there's questions that need to be answered. So I found it kind of like, maybe it's just a little too loose with, you know, the over, you know, loose with the I guess the over, or the oversight than I would like personally, you know, some accountability there.
Big time. And if you got that much money kind of being poured into it and you got this many people doing it, I mean, it's kind of incumbent upon the company in order to show what you're using the money for, to kind of, hey, guys, we got these big pre-production that we're doing. We're creating practical effects for this and that. This is where your money's going, basically.
Right. Yeah.
So that would be very nice if they were to do that. But yeah, at the end of the day, like you said, it really just comes down to, do you have enough money and friends in order to buy this, your way into this contest or to win it.
Right.
You know, which is kind of unfair. Now if it was all based on merits or something like that, that's different. But I get it. They're trying to raise money. Hell, I wish I would have thought about this. I mean, they're probably making money hand over fist for this thing.
No doubt. Yes. No doubt.
But you know, we're all familiar with the crowdfunding campaigns where it's like, hey, donate X amount of money and you get to be executive producer, or you get to be killed in the film or something like that. Now,
right.
You got to get creative as an indie filmmaker in order to raise money and do stuff like that. But also, there's a certain amount of integrity that you have to adhere to or bring to it. You know, and if you're just willy-nilly just handing out parts to any Joe Blow who's willing to donate 50, 100, 200 bucks or whatever to your movie, then, you know, is your vision really coming to life? Are you really hiring the best people? You know, there's a lot of people who do that, though. And, you know, I don't fault them at all for it. Now, if it's something like an executive producer position or something like that, I get that. You know, that's not somebody who's going to be in front of the camera and, you know, could potentially bring down your film in any way just for being able to donate to it.
Right.
But when it comes to something like acting, yeah, it just feels a little weird. To put it one way. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Have you ever crowdfunded and offered those kind of perks, or you know other filmmakers who have?
I myself have never run a crowdfunding campaign, never been on a project that necessitated one. Or okay. And you know, so I understand the logistics that go into it. It's just right. You know, it's very, very, and from the other directors and individuals I've spoken with on the show, it's a very, very daunting task that you have the dedicated crew that's necessary to continue to push the thing. You need someone to kind of organize all that stuff. And it's got to be, you got to be on it like all the time, pushing that thing forward, pushing it out, like that. And then of course, you know, having the right perks, having attractive perks. And then of course, having all the media you need so that people get a good idea of what your vision is.
Yeah.
It requires its own team in and of itself. And it's just like, damn, it's like a whole other, it's like literally a whole other production.
It is.
You know,
is.
Like you're hiring a whole unit in order to do this one thing. So
yeah, just the crowdfunding unit. You just got to have a whole crowdfunding unit just to engage with people, to post it, to try and do ads and stuff like that. It's a lot. Obviously, if we could just have somebody hand us a bag full of money and say, hey, go make a movie, I mean, that would be preferred. But we're in a very expensive artistic profession, you know, compared to other ones. You know, writing, obviously, all you need is, you know, laptop and a copy of Final Draft, and you're kind of good to go there. That's all the investment you need. But if you're doing something like filmmaking, I mean, as you know, the costs just add up exponentially more than any other art form out there. You want to be a painter? That's a little expensive. You got to buy paint. You got to buy canvas, all that sort of stuff. But it doesn't compare to buying a $30,000 camera or, you know, $100,000 to pay your crew and actors for, you know, a feature film shoot. So it adds up. It really adds up. But I feel like crowdfunding can only kind of go so far in terms of how much you're able to utilize it and how much you're able to kind of hit up the same people over and over again for money. I personally don't like having to post a crowdfunding campaign and more or less kind of beg people like, hey, please fund my dream and my passion, you know?
I can see that with you. You got your cup out. Please, we'll shoot movie for Town Agents. Like, come on, y'all.
Please, yeah. I'll stand out on the 10 freeway, you know, and hold the sign up and probably get a better chance then. But, you know, you have to do it. And I feel like you can do it a few times, but after you've made like 1, 2, 3 features or something, if you're still crowdfunding, then, I mean, you, at that point, you just got to find some investors. I mean, you know, go to a dentist's office, talk to your dentist, find somebody
who wants that. I see you've read Lloyd Kaufman's book. I see.
Exactly.
That's how it works. I was just thinking that.
That's real talk. I mean, you got to hit the ground running. And a good friend of mine who I worked with, I was an AD on his feature film, Stay With Me. He's about to release a book all on independent filmmaking crowdfunding. Coming out probably later next year. His name is Marty, a very, very good friend of mine, a very good screenwriter, filmmaker. So that would be a very valuable resource for filmmakers to check out in order to utilize that as much as they can and, you know, not try to compromise the integrity of their film by trying to populate it with, you know, people who are just donating in order to be a part of it in that regard. So, but it has its place for sure. And I mean, we need finishing funds for Meat Hook. But I've held off on doing any further crowdfunding campaigns just for the fact that I've done them and I see how much we get. And unless you do have a dedicated team, like you said, pushing it constantly, monitoring it, engaging with people, making sure everybody gets their perks. And it's very difficult. And, you know, if you're just the filmmaker doing that, and then you're also trying to work on pre-production, production post, anything like that, it becomes very daunting, and it could take away from other elements that could use your attention better.
Right.
Other, you know, and the money thing in filmmaking, I mean, it's always going to be there. It's something that you can't escape, but you know,
the one thing I really didn't, the one big takeaway from like something like Face of Horror, as opposed to like Kickstarter or Indiegogo or something like that, the one issue that I had that it kept popping up into my mind from a business perspective was that I didn't like the kind of image that it gave to this form of crowdfunding of the way they handled it, because if so many people were involved and then suddenly nothing comes of it. It's like, where did all the money go? Where did the 75% go?
Right.
That kind of, that word like that can spread virally especially amongst the horror community, especially if it's a horror, you know, the very insular, very welcoming, but very insular community.
Oh yeah.
And so what I found was, it's like, man, if nothing comes of this and they get a bad rep for this, that could reflect on all of us if we try to go in there, because everybody's going, oh, remember that Face of Horror contest?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And so that makes it more, and that makes people a little bit more reticent in trying, you know, giving up their money. So I didn't like that aspect.
Right.
So that's why I didn't jump in on the second round. I didn't do it again. So I was kind of like,
yeah,
I'll just, you know, like let it carry on. But nonetheless, crowdfunding, yes, it, everyone who's been on here has talked about it. It's a different kind of animal. It's like a whole beast unto itself.
It is. It's a necessary evil sometimes, but you know, we're trying to make movies out here. Movies cost money. So at the end of the day, you're going to do what you can for your vision. And if you got to hit up some friends and family for it, do what you got to do. You know, hell, if you want to offer people parts in your movie for money, then, you know, by all means do it. I don't know what kind of movie you're making, you know, maybe it doesn't require, you know, the person being killed to have particular acting skills, you know, but you know, that's all up to the individual filmmaker and what they do. And I don't fault any filmmakers for going that route. And I'm sure definitely in the future, I'll be running another crowdfunding campaign in order to beg people to throw fucking quarters in my cup. But you know, this is kind of the nature of the game. This is what we got into, yeah. JL. So, you know, speaking of which,
so like, so you started, I mean, I was looking back at it and, you know, given like a graduate, you graduated from CSU Northridge and then moved on to your fellowship in the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which was really, really badass. Now, going into it, like when you were going into this, it was like, what were your inspirations going in? Like, what got you here? You know, just like, because, you know, picking up the baton and getting, it's like, you know, I'm going to go into this industry and I'm going to do this thing. That's not everybody. It's a, you know, as many of us as there are, this is a small family. So what kind of encouraged you to like, this is what I'm going to go, this is what I'm going to do?
I think it really just starts off with a dream and a passion. You know, we love films. You're on here every week talking about horror and your love for films along with the guests and everybody. Mm-hmm. So that's where it really starts off with. And you have to have that feeling that if I wasn't doing this, I don't know what the hell else I would do. You know, it's got to be like, this is it. This is what I'm going for. And it's balls to the wall. And it's, you know, if you want to have a backup, you know, if you want to have a degree in business or, you know, whatever to fall back on, I mean, you got to do what you got to do, you know, and it doesn't work out for everybody. But at the end of the day, if you love something, if you really care about it, if you're passionate enough, if you have stories out there that you want to tell, that you want to get out, then you're going to do whatever you have to in order to get it done. Sometimes it's just ignorance of knowing how difficult it is to pull things off, which gets you through to that point, you know. I'm sure on your first films and everybody else's, you kind of go into it with a sense of naivete that you can do whatever, you can accomplish whatever, your movie can be the thing, it can be Halloween. And then once you get into the editing room and then you start seeing, well, oh man, this shot could have been framed better, I could have got better focus on this, the performance could have been better here, I could have wrote down some better dialogue. Then you start learning, then you start becoming a filmmaker, then you start growing and you start finding out what your voice is and what your style is. So when it came time and I was going to college and we had to pick a major, after taking a few film classes, and I've been in love with film my whole life since a child, watching horror films, all sorts of films, just a cinephile through and through.
Do you remember what your first one was?
Oh man, that is a great question. I wish I had an answer to that, JL. I will tell you though, one movie that I watched repeatedly over and over, and my mom and brother would remind me of this. We had a copy of Aliens on VHS, but we only had like the last half of it because it was taped off like HBO. I think it was when like maybe Bishop got into the tunnels or something like that. So, you know, started off right there, going all the way through the end, just running over and over. So that's one of my earliest memories, is watching Aliens, which is one of my favorite films.
Nice. My earliest one, Ghostbusters. And, you know, when that first came out, my parents took me to see that in theaters when that came out in 80, it was like 82. Yeah. And my second one after that, like immediately, almost back to back, but, you know, my second one after that was Gremlins. Joe Dante's legendary one was Gremlins at the drive-in. So that was, so we were, because I used to live in California, because I was born in California. So we went to the drive-in in California, and you got the, like, I still remember sitting in the car, got the metal speaker right there hanging on the window, and seeing Gremlins for the first time. So Gremlins at the drive-in and Ghostbusters, you know, when it was in theater, during its theatrical run, those are my first two big ones. And then at home, as far as like watching stuff, The Thing. Because my uncle showed me The Thing, and you know, that was, you could tell, like, as you look around my office, you know, like, John Carpenter was extremely influential.
Forward.
So, and I was like, something about Carpenter just stuck in my mind. Lovecraftian and horror and shit like that. So,
big time.
I love those early inspirations.
That's a great first couple of movies. Now, do you actually remember it, or did somebody have to tell you like, oh, this was your first movie, or is it something that's just baked into your mind?
I remember specific moments that got me. So in Ghostbusters, there was the library moment.
That is
embedded in my memory.
She was spooky.
Like, absolutely. Yeah. So like where we were in the theater, like what was next? So I remember like we were sitting off to the left. We were actually near the wall at kind of an angle like that. And I remember that. I remember with Gremlins, it was the bar scene and the pool scene are most in my mind.
Nice.
Those would click there. But with The Thing, it was always the dogs. It was always my first memory was my uncle saying, hey, we're going to watch this. And I was like, okay, let's watch this. And we watched that. And it was the dog, the kennel scene that got me every time. And it was just but yeah, those informed me going forward, especially as a filmmaker and as a writer. So
that's why you're a huge horror nut right now. Because your parents took you to those Ghostbusters and Gremlins. Those are actually a little bit more comedic horror. Do you veer more towards comedic horror, or would you say it's more traditional horror?
So I think I started with comedy because, you know, I was so young and my parents wouldn't subject, or my mom and dad wouldn't subject me to the harder stuff. And I think once I was a little bit older, so that kind of like horror was like being scared was fun.
Yeah.
And so that got me. So like scary stories, you know, especially as a child. But then it was when I got into like the harder stuff when my uncle introduced me to that, to the much more, you know, so like Halloween, Friday the 13th.
The hard stuff.
Right. So when he gets me into like the slasher genre and the real sci-fi horror stuff, that kind of solidified me. It was like, oh, like I dig this concept of it. Like, you know, and it was Carpenter, the creeping dread, the fear that you don't see. And then of course for my dad, it was the same. It was Jaws. Because for my dad, it was always like, because my dad worked in the theater when he was young, and they actually got to screen Jaws when that came out.
Oh, nice.
So when they were doing that, and it was like it was always the thing you don't see is the fucking scariest, because your mind does all the work for you.
Right.
And as a writer, and I think you can relate to this, that crafting those moments of when you're allowing the audience to put those pieces together, you give them just enough. And then they start putting it, that's the magic. And I love creating scenes like that where the audience is like, oh shit, exactly. I think I know this is going to go. Oh fuck, this is going to be so bad when it happens. And then you unleash that. I love doing that.
And it might come not exactly from the screenplay itself, but in the case of Jaws, just, you know, problems with production, just any sort of production that might pop up. So, I mean, we might be talking in a whole different light if we were seeing him all throughout the film, but because of the technical hiccups and how Steven Spielberg was able to adjust and pivot to that. I mean, that's why we got Jaws, and that's why it's so eerie. Because I mean, he is literally, you don't see him a lot. You might see the fin at the beginning of the movie, but the dread, everything is underneath the surface. He's lurking, he's out there, but we don't see him, and that's even scarier, you know?
So, I think that worked. He had that instinct, I think, coming off a duel. Because you never see the truck driver. All you see is his boots. Like, who is this faceless person
that is stalking
our hero? And it's because it could be anybody. You know? Yeah. It's like you never know who it could be. And it's like, I love that notion.
Mystery.
Like, that mystery. Who is this guy? Does he look like a villain? Could he be, I'm a homicidal maniac. They could be anybody. I love that notion in that. So that rang that bell for me. That's why I went deep into like Lovecraft and Poe, and nice. You know, those are my big inspirations.
Yeah.
Now, you have a host of short films.
I do.
Now I got to check out the ones that I found found available. Crime Scene was great. I really enjoyed Crime Scene. Nice short little noir style thriller. I love the fact that you threw that you had the Cowboy Bebop outro. And there, I thought that was really, really neat.
Oh, okay, yeah. I didn't actually throw that on there. I think our director did. So I couldn't even tell it was Cowboy Bebop. But damn, you went into the crates. You dug in deep. That was like an early student film that we made. Oh shit. Okay, I could have sent you some better stuff than that. That's okay though. That's okay. Crime Scene was good. Crime Scene was fun. Thanks for taking time to watch that. That's crazy.
Absolutely. Well, actually, one, you know, I saw, because I saw it, and I was like, oh, let me check this out. It's like, ooh, black and white kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I like the director's choice there. I'm going to see how the writing goes with the characterizations. And I love the little choices that were in there. The acting was, you know, that's some good instincts there. Totally. I was like, this is really solid. This is a nice little film. Just a nice little noir style, you know, like in his head kind of thing. I kind of dug that in kind of like a modern setting. So that was fun. And I just, you know, as far as writing goes, that was just really, really strong. Just, you know, what you gave him to work with. And it showed a real grasp of that genre of writing, because not everybody could pull off noir. That's tough. Especially, you know, you can get like some Frank Miller neo-noir where everybody's like, you know, you know, like that. But I like that classic, almost bogey kind of, you know, sensation there. I kind of dug that.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of noir films, and you mentioned Bogey. I've been a big fan of Casablanca for a long time. I heard somebody, I think it was Mick Garris on his podcast, Postmortem, which was recently talking about noirs, and he was saying noir is almost like a sister or a sibling of horror in many ways. There is a very dark, atmospheric undertone throughout the genre, which is very similar to horror.
You think giallo? I would say that Italian giallo films, definitely that connective tissue in between those two, because Italian filmmakers always willing to push that envelope and go, that's what I loved. With Italian horror is a big inspiration for me as well. And that's because Italian horror, I think filmmakers, I don't know, do you have a favorite Italian?
I mean, the two biggest ones, obviously, that come to mind are Fulci and Argento, and I'm a big fan of Fulci, personally. I know Argento is probably the more revered one, obviously, because Suspiria, things like that. But
Three Mothers trilogy,
Yeah, but to me personally, and I was just at the theater, I don't know, last month at the New Bev, watching a double of Fulci's films. What was it? It was House by the Cemetery and The Gates of Hell.
Fucking A, yes.
Yeah, two great ones. I love House by the Cemetery. That whole bat scene. Oh my god. Fulci, you know, he's in a class of his own. You know, he's a very distinctive filmmaker. I haven't checked out any of his like crime thriller movies that he did before he got like big into horror. I know he did like a bunch of crime shit like in the 70s and maybe 60s, but yeah, it's his horror stuff that really stands out. Which one are you more of a big fan of? Is it Argento or is it Fulci? I feel like there's two camps.
I love. Oh, okay. So I wasn't gonna say. I wasn't gonna say Fulci. But I will. I will say that I have two favorites. I have two favorites that I really, really dig, and I really love. I really love Argento for his style, for his stylization.
Yeah.
And you can see the early Roman Catholic influence in virtually everything he does. You see that in, you know, the architecture he chooses to use, the colors he chooses to use.
Totally.
I like that inspiration, that almost Alighieri inspiration he brings to what he does. So I love him for his style. But as far as like putting like balls to the wall shit, I really love Lindsay. Umberto Lenzi is one of my...
Oh, Umberto Lenzi. Yeah, okay, you're throwing up some other ones here.
I fucking love Demons. I love Demons.
Oh, that's right. He did Demons. Yeah, okay.
Right. And I love, because I loved it, because it was right there after the breakdown, like around the time that the Berlin Wall was falling and things were kind of out of control. And there was like rumors of war and shit. And that whole post-apocalyptic, almost, you know, like that bleak ending of Demons, I thought that was fantastic. Yep. And then Bava came and picked up with Demons too. I thought he did really, really good in his own light.
Oh,
but
yeah,
I really love that Italian filmmakers, especially the horror filmmakers, it was never really a one-upmanship, like who can do it and who can do it better. It was always about, right, I'm going to push the envelope this far. Now, who's going to like challenge me? Who's going to like push it even further? Oh, I'm going to push it even further. I'm going to do this. Yeah. And that's how we get like the cannibal horror films that we got, and the really like Ferox and Holocaust.
They pushed the envelope. Yeah, they weren't playing around over there. Those Italians, they know how to make a fucking horror movie. That's for real.
I love that sense of team play, that we're all in this together. It's something that is sorely missing from the American mentality of filmmaking. Because the rising tide lifts all boats. And I think that we don't have to like dump money into each other's productions, but we don't have to be like, I'm going to beat you so that you don't make any money.
Exactly.
It's like, no, it's like, oh, I hope you're successful, because whatever you do, you're going to inspire me to elevate my game. And then we're going to work hand in hand. And sometimes these guys work together. Fulci and Bava and Lenzi and Argento. I mean, you know, that's how Asia got her start. So that's what I loved about that filmmaker.
True. And even Argento with Romero, Two Evil Eyes,
yes,
was their anthology film. And obviously the collaboration between King and Romero, one of the best horror collaborations probably in film with Creepshow.
Oh, yeah. King, Romero, Savini. Yeah.
Oh, my God. The trifecta. Are you kidding me?
All Jesus working together.
Christ. Yeah.
Fantastic stuff. Now, and I will say, you know, because you do have, because you have some horror stuff in there, because, you know, like, I'm gonna make sure I get it, like, Among the Mistletoe, that really kind of, like, dark thriller there, and then you also had, you worked on Found Footage of Fear, which was that kind of, very VHS style, in that respect, kind of in that vein of Found Footage stuff.
Yeah,
and
that was an anthology film. I did one of the shorts that was in there called Unboxed. Yeah, that was really fun.
But I want to give you some props. It's non-horror related, but I really enjoyed Golden Age.
I thought you were about to say that. You watched it. Okay, nice. Yeah, Golden Age was fun. Not horror related, but... I don't know if you're a fan of Pleasantville or the John Ritter film Stay Tuned or classic or the
Dwayne's Underworld. Yeah, oh, I love that movie.
That's a classic. It's a classic. Brilliant. Anything where like a character gets sucked into something and they're out of their elements and they're kind of a fish out of water, I'm all about that. Pleasantville, Stay Tuned being examples. Also the elements of the nursing home and the older people and being young again and kind of capturing their youth. That inspiration came a lot from the Twilight Zone movies segment directed by Steven Spielberg called Kick the Can, if you remember that one at all.
Yes.
Yeah. So a lot of inspirations there. One of the biggest inspirations as well outside of other films was just what happens to actors after they've retired or after their star has dimmed in the spotlight, and what happens to these people and how they are able to continue on in life and be remembered and have this piece of history that they're forever immortalized in. There's something about that which is just very interesting that I wanted to explore a little bit, and I think we did with the character of the grandmother. And we had a really great time shooting that film. That was our senior thesis film that we did, and we got a few awards from it from the film festival circuit. So that was a really nice, lighthearted film. Maybe one day I'll go back to making another nice, lighthearted film. But there's always an element of comedy, I think, in my films. Being a big fan of horror comedies such as Gremlins and Ghostbusters, like you, and other horror comedies as well. I mean, Shaun of the Dead. There's just so many out there.
Oh, Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen that yet. Wow. I'm ashamed to say that I haven't, because every time I try and look up a list of like, oh man, I want to watch a comedy horror film. Let me see like a list of them. That one always pops up, but I haven't gotten around to it yet. Oh, one of these days I'm going to rectify that.
It is so brilliant. I don't want to spoil anything, but Alan Tudyk and Tyler Labine are fucking genius in that whole thing. Like, everything they do is so patriotic. I hope you get to see it soon. But definitely.
I've seen the trailers. I'm intrigued. I'm interested. One of these days, I'm going to rectify that, and we'll have to compare notes afterwards on that.
I just love that. Well, Sheriff, we have had ourselves a doozy of a day. I freaking love that scene with all of them. We do watch parties occasionally over on our Discord, over on our Weird Horror Discord, and I've shown that one a few times. People always get a kick out of it, so that's always a fun one. But I love Golden Age. I love that it had the thing I equated to is it had this King vibe to it. Not King's darker stuff, but very much very Hearts in Atlantis, very golden years kind of thing. And I thought, it was like his lighter fare. And I was like, this is a wonderful little story. And I dig this. And because you don't shy away from the potential implications of like what is going on here. And then it kind of resolves it. And then when it resolves itself, I don't want to spoil anything for you. We're going to put the link for it down in the description. But I just thoroughly enjoyed it as just a wonderful little story to tell. And so I thought that was really cool. And that gave me a good, and it gives, I think gives us a really excellent sense of what you're trying to accomplish as a director and both as a writer and a director and what you're trying to convey in the stories that you want to tell, which I found really good with A Creature is Stirring.
Yes.
Which I found that to be really, because it's so different. And I like what you brought into that. What led to that as far as your inspirations?
As far as Creature, how the hell did this start? Let me think about that. I think it really just came from wanting to make a horror short film and wanting to do something that takes place around the holidays. That wasn't just a slasher, because I feel like that's been done to death with holiday films. Yeah. Silent Night, Deadly Night, Christmas Evil, my favorite. So I wanted to do something that had like a ghost element to it. So that's how we created that. And obviously Russell Coker, who was a guest on before, he's one of the lead characters in that. He did a great job. So that was really fun. We had a great time with that. We actually put that out right before Mistletoe. And I had the whole, we shot it at my house. We had the whole house decorated for Christmas. We had the tree, presents, everything like that. And while I had all that there, I'm like, well, shit, we got all these decorations up. Let's just film another.
Production value, baby.
Let's just film another one. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to put all this stuff away. And then, you know, we already got it here. What can we do? So that's when I came up with the idea for Among the Mistletoe, which is a very twisty, suspenseful thriller short film that takes place around the holidays that really has a lot of Shyamalan, M. Night Shyamalan kind of twist to it that I like to say. That was my whole genesis behind making that was, one, let's utilize the production and everything that we already have up just to shoot something else. And let's make a story that just has a shit ton of twists in it. Let's just get the audience dizzy with how many twists are going on when we created that. And that was a really fun project to work on. We had a lot of really great actors and crew who worked on that film. And actually, we're trying to put that as part of an anthology. I'm working currently on finding other Christmas holiday related short films, which we can utilize and put together as one film with one wraparound story. That's a project which I've been kind of in digestion of for the past year or so. I have a couple filmmakers who have agreed to include their short films with it. So hopefully by next holiday season, we're going to have that out. And that'll be including among the Mistletoe in it as well. So keep an eye out.
Very cool. Absolutely. And I dig that it wasn't the classic one that, cause we so often either get like Monster at Christmas or we get, like for example, on the upcoming episode of Week in Horror, we're going to talk about a movie called Scary Little Fuckers, which was about an alcoholic dad who brings home a gift for his son to try and make amends. Okay. And it's a monster. And it gets loose, and you know, it's very Gremlins, but a lot more meta and a lot more self-referential comedy in that one. But I, you know, like you said, there's a lot of slashers, there's a lot of like monster stuff, and I like that you went somewhere new with it and gave it I think it was original as you can get, which I really, really dug. Which I think if people get a chance to check that out, that they should definitely see that just to get like a break from the rigmarole of what we usually get.
Yeah,
I will. Uh huh.
Yeah, totally. And we actually had the pleasure of having Shorts TV reach out to us to license that film for a short period of time. So last holiday season, it played on their network. I don't know if they're still running it or not, if our license is still with them or not. But yeah, that was a really fun project to work on. Obviously, any horror story which takes place around the holidays is ripe for telling. Halloween, Thanksgiving, which is out right now.
Yes.
Which I'm very much looking forward to seeing. So no spoilers, please, because I haven't checked it out yet.
It was like 15 years we're waiting for that movie since the fake trailer
came out. I remember sitting in the theater, yeah, watching the original Grindhouse with Planet Terror and Death Proof. And yeah, when the hell are they going to make this thing? So I'm really glad that Eli Roth was able to bring that story to life and make that fruition, because we were really lacking some good Thanksgiving horror films.
Yes. I think I was so pleased because I was like, man, tell me we're not going to peak, because there were so many there. I was like, we got Machete. Tell me we're not going to peak with Hobo with tell me we're not going to peak with Hobo with a shotgun. Rutger Hauer. Oh, Rutger Hauer in that role. R.I.P. Was just brilliant. I just loved it, what he brought to that. But then we got Thanksgiving, which I'm so glad. I haven't seen it myself yet. I plan to once I get the opportunity.
Same.
But the last Christmas one I saw was Bagos' Christmas Bloody Christmas. And
with the animatronic Santa.
Right, with the Terminator Santa.
That was fun. Yeah. I like that. Yeah.
And I did, that was the last one I got to see. So once again, it's ostensibly essentially a slasher, you know, going
it
forward.
Is.
I was kind of, so it was nice. It was nice to see yours and what you brought to that, do something a little bit different than what people were expecting. So I love that.
You're too kind, Jay. Let me ask you this.
Uh-huh.
What is your favorite Christmas or holiday horror film?
Trick or Treat.
Ah, okay. Yeah. No, that's solid. Yeah.
Yeah. His Trick or Treat is my annual. It's an annual Halloween
classic.
Yeah. Every year we watch that. We start with that. Got to watch Trick or Treat. And then we decide some other stuff we're going to wear, but always Trick or Treat. I love that movie.
What about Christmas horror film? What would be your pick for favorite Christmas horror film?
My number one favorite Christmas horror film is I'm actually going to go Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Okay.
Because I think because that holds special place for me, because, you know, the image of Santa and the image of Christmas and what that, you know, culturally and societally, what that kind of embodies. And that movie flipped all of that on its head.
It sure did. For that movie
to come out and then for 2 weeks to have a 2 week run and then be yanked from theaters because of the outrage.
Controversy.
That's the point. That's literally the point, is to challenge people and to put forth stories that make people think.
Yeah.
And if you can have that kind of effect with just this one little film about a crazy guy wearing a Santa suit, but it's that opening sequence that gets people, though, which even to me is kind of like, fuck, man. It's like when they were shooting that, it's like you got to imagine the director behind the camera. And he's like, okay, now Santa's going to do this. You're like, and people are going like, oh, is he really thinking this is going to release? Like, everybody's like, it's going to release.
Theatrically, too. Oh, my God. Yeah, no, I love Silent Night, Deadly Night. That's great. They're actually showing that at the new Bev next month, paired with Black Christmas. It already sold out. But to me, it would have to be Christmas Evil. I love Christmas Evil. I love the character. I love the journey. I love the arc. I love the ending. Like, it's just, it's the quintessential killer Santa movie for me. I just watched that, I think, last holiday season for the first time, and it was just blown away by how amazing it was. You've seen Christmas Evil, I'm sure.
Yes, not recently, unfortunately, but I did one I'm gonna have to go back and watch again, because it's been a fair minute. The most recent one, as far as killer Santas go, other than Christmas Bloody Christmas, was the Tales from the Crypt episode with Larry Drake, when he played the killer Santa.
Oh my God. Classic. All Through the House? Was that
All Through the House? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's a classic.
Early Tales from the Crypt before they went full camp. And it had that kind of like dark overtone to it.
Right,
I love that. And Larry Drake was just fantastic.
Oh, Dr. Giggles. Like, Dr. Giggles. Back to fucking more people. Yeah. That's great. Who directed that? Was that Richard Donner that did that one? Or, I can't remember. Maybe it was Zemeckis. I don't know. There's so many great episodes in that TV show. Love Tales from the Crypt. Yeah, and that's even better than actually the Tales from the Crypt movie segment, which they had of All Through the House. I actually prefer the show adaptation of that even better than the film.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Zemeckis who dropped that one.
And it was Zemeckis. Okay, yeah.
It's surprising how few people like. You think people think Robert Zemeckis, and they attach the his bigger name films. So it was like, oh, remember he also did this. It was like, yes.
He was a horror. He was a fan of the EC Comics big time. Yeah, no, he did a lot of great episodes on there. I thought it was Richard Donner because it has the therapist from the Lethal Weapon movies playing the mother in it.
Playing the bitch of a mother. I'm sorry, because she won.
No, she's great. No, she kills the husband. You know, she's trying to cover it up. I mean, there's a lot of suspense in that episode. I mean... Yeah, that one, I feel like that's a holiday classic right there that everybody should watch every year for sure.
That I always thought that was the brilliance of Tales from the Crypt, is that the stories they told were never just one faceted, that there's always multiple things that are going on that drive it. You can have a monster one, but they always paid so much attention to the dynamics of the characters themselves, which I thought was brilliant. That's why I try to do it. It's like I look at things like that from Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side. And so taking those is like you can't just focus on the one big thing. You've got to have things that go on, but otherwise make these characters interesting. Why do we care about them? One of my favorites is the ice cream. I can't remember the title of it, but the ice cream vendor guy that Bill Paxton and Brad Dourif were trying to like rob. Yeah. And the thing that gets me is not the fact that it's a Siamese, the guy who's like a conjoined twin and they kill his brother. It's like, that was the shock reveal. What I loved was the dynamic between Dourif and Paxton. The two of them as brothers was just, I was like, I fucking love these two,
Let's just have a whole movie with these guys.
Right.
Yeah. So, that was great. That was a great episode too. Yeah. Oh man, I missed that show. I know Shyamalan was supposed to do like a reboot of that for TNT like a couple of years ago and something with the rights never worked out, but oh man. Yeah. Well, I don't know why the hell HBO Max hasn't put those up on their streaming service yet. That's a shame.
They should. Yeah, absolutely.
One of their flagship shows.
So I know. So you also have, apart from all the shorts you've done and you've got, we're going to talk about Meat Hook here in a second, but I talked with you earlier about how we got into Weekend Horror came about and how the pandemic kind of like opened up this niche for us to do the style of show that we're doing. You also have a podcast as well, and you're just kicked off about the same time as ours did. And I'm kind of curious, did you kind of run into the same thing where that niche kind of opened up for you, or because it was fortuitous?
Yeah, I think part of the pandemic, just like with Weekend Horror, I think that definitely played a factor into the creation and genesis of it. Just having that spare time and just having other people around who had spare time on their hands in order to sit around and just talk movies, review stuff. So yeah, I don't have a whole lot of episodes on there. I'm not as consistent or prolific as you guys are over there, because you guys are doing a great job. But so it's very kind of haphazard whenever we release episodes, but the ones we have released, we have some really great discussions about just different topics. One of them was like the censorship in film and television, a topic very near and dear to my heart. That's definitely a problem right now. So that, and then also, in addition to the podcast, Cinephobia is also like a YouTube channel. It's kind of like a hybrid thing. So I do video essays on there. I think I only have like a couple on there, but probably the most popular one thus far has been the one that I did on Halloween Resurrection called Halloween Resurrection Ain't That Bad. I know a lot of people hate Resurrection. I'm a little bit of an apologist when it comes to that film. It does hold a little special place in my heart from when first viewing it. And I did feel like it was getting a very bad rap. So I felt compelled in order to create this 20-minute video, which took forever to fucking make, and put it out there. So if anybody out there is a Halloween fan or hates Resurrection, loves Resurrection, check it out. Cinephobia. Yeah, we're on YouTube, we're on Spotify, wherever podcasts, Apple Podcasts. Check us out.
You see, now that makes me feel good about myself, because you can see the silver lining in a lot of projects. And I have the reputation on the show of being the guy who tries to see the silver lining in virtually everything we watch. Very rarely do I think I can count on one hand the number of films that I hate. that I actually watch, and I just like, I hate them just for totally. For everything they are. Yeah. I will always give credit to get for someone to get something in the can, because I know how much of a bitch that is to get it in the fucking can. And I'll always try to give credit for that. But there are some movies that I just can't fucking stand. But unlike Johnny O, our other host, who hates everything. And yes, he will listen to this. You hate everything, Johnny. And no one's going to.
Okay. All right, Johnny.
But I always try to find that silver lining in that. And I can see those little details. I love that. So I like this what we have here. This is good. Someone after my own heart. I kind of dig that.
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. If you want to be on the guest on the cast too, I'd love to have you on. You know, we could do a little cross platform sort of thing.
Fuck yeah.
As you can tell, I like asking people questions too. So, yeah, man, let me know if you're down for that sometime.
Hell yeah. We'll spread the gore. Fuck yes.
Let's do it.
All right. And you also, but cinephobia is not the only thing you've got, because in 2022, and I have it pulled up and I'm not all the way through it yet, but you've got Savage Warning.
Oh, Savage Waking.
Savage Waking. My apologies. I'm not all the way through it yet, because I just didn't have time to finish the whole thing.
No worries. But yeah, it's a long one.
That is fascinating as well. What got you onto that one?
Yeah, that was a really fun project. So that's an audio drama. That's not a visual or a short film or anything like that. It's an audio drama. And that was a collaboration with Invictum Digital, who creates these really well put together, really well produced audio dramas. So the creator of the company, Jonathan Winstead, he reached out to me on this platform that I'm on, and he asked if I was interested in writing the script for it. He had a general outline that he wanted to stick to, and a theme and kind of a twist at the end that he wanted to explore. So he hired me to do that, and he was a great guy to work with. Very easy to collaborate with, had a lot of great ideas, was very susceptible to a lot of ideas that I had. So Savage Waking Obliteration is a zombie story that takes place in a small town. An earthquake just happened, and some gas has been released, and the local cemetery, all the graves have been upended, and that's where we pick up on the story. And there is definitely some comedic elements into the film, which is one of the reasons why I was really excited to tell it. So there is a twist that kind of happens towards the end, much like a lot of the films and stories that I make. That happens. So check it out when you guys get a chance. It's on a lot of different platforms out there. But if you look up Invictum Digital, you guys will be able to find it. So if you're a fan of zombie films, if you're a fan of horror comedies, it's a really fun, engaging story. We've got some great dialogue, great voice actors in it. Really bringing the characters to life, which we wrote. So, and that was my first foray into audio drama. So that was really fun. I got to do that. And I don't think it's anywhere on my IMDb or anywhere, but I did do some story writing for a VR game, which is out. The name escapes me at the moment, which I feel very bad about, but I did do a little writing on that. So it is kind of interesting to branch out into different facets of media to kind of see how it is telling stories like that. Because obviously you and me, we're used to telling in a very visual medium. So adapting to the audio drama audience and structure was very unique to kind of tell everything, because we're told show, don't tell. Whereas this thing is the exact opposite. You got to tell everything. So that was really fun to play around with that. And that's been very popular. We won a lot of awards for that project. And they're currently have another project out right now, which is more of an action adventure, Indiana Jones-esque audio drama. So yeah, definitely check them out. They're doing a lot of fantastic work over there. Shout out to Jonathan Winstead for hiring me to work on the project, for being such a great collaborator. So yeah, Savage Waking Obliteration.
And I've got, that's available on YouTube in its entirety under the Invictum Digital's YouTube channel is where they checked that out, was where I pulled it up. It's fascinating. I love that little, you know, taking place in the town of Monroeville. I thought it was really, really interesting. And I love how these characters are coming together. Can't wait to see how it ends. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm only about halfway through, so I don't want to spoil anything. Yeah, definitely.
I'm
check
really
it out.
Curious. know what you say. And yeah, it takes place in the town of Monroeville. If you're a fan of zombie films, you might know Monroeville is the name of the town. From was it Dawn of the Dead? It was Dawn of the Dead.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I heard that. I was like, ah, Pennsylvania. Yes.
Monroeville Mall. Yes. Yes. So I love throwing little Easter eggs and shit like that in films, either names of actors who I'm a big fan of, or filmmakers, or the name of a town, you know, from a very obscure horror film, which people might not know about. Not that Dawn of the Dead is obscure. But yeah, you get the idea.
Absolutely. Now that brings us to the Big Mama Jama, the badass poster that you have sitting behind you right now. Yes. For Meat Hook.
Meat Hook, yes. Shout out to the guy who created this poster, by the way, Alex Ivick. He's on Instagram. You guys can check him out. He's a really fantastic poster artist. He did this whole thing by hand, created this for us. So really proud of this poster. We just released it on Halloween. And the movie Meat Hook itself, we've been in post-production on it for a while, but it is finally going to be seeing the light of day. We are going to be releasing it next year. We are in the final throes of post-production, which have taken entirely too freaking long. But we're almost at the end, and I'm really excited to put it out for people. We put a lot of passion, a lot of time, a lot of energy into making this film the best it can possibly be. We have a lot of fun surprises in there, which people might not be expecting from a slasher film. So yeah, Meat Hook, dropping next year. And obviously we were talking about Russell Coker. He was the casting director on it, as well as playing an actor in a college student. We had this one scene that he was in, as well as playing the killer himself in a couple scenes. And speaking of the killer, we had a few people playing the killer, actually, since we shot it over such a long period of time. We do have one main actor who plays him whenever we don't see him with the mask on. He also plays him in a lot of other scenes where we just see him walking and stalking and things like that. But luckily, Russell was kind enough to lend his physique and frame and everything to some of these shots with the killer. And you mentioned the trailer a little bit earlier as well, which you said you liked. Thanks for checking it out. The trailer, funny story about that actually, is we only had about half the movie filmed when we cut the trailer. It's a teaser trailer in all respects. So if you look at the comments on YouTube, you'll see a lot of people saying, oh, I think this person's the killer, or I think this person has a split personality and they're really the one doing it. When in all actuality, we didn't have all the footage, but we didn't have any footage of the killer at that point. So very interesting in that regard. We also have some scenes in there which never made it into the film as well. So yeah, we're actually going to be releasing an official trailer hopefully very early next year. My good friend Doug Jensen, who works at a trailer house, we went to school together as well, along with Russell. He's a fantastic editor, fantastic filmmaker and storyteller. He's going to be cutting our trailer. He also cut the trailer for the Batman film with Robert Pattinson, which was very successful, along with other very successful trailers put out there. So very excited to finally get a big official trailer out there to give people a really good idea on what to expect from this the slasher film, which we've been working on for so long.
Definitely. And yeah, for those who haven't seen that trailer, the trailer is available. We'll have that link there so you can check that out as well, because just from the look of it, I think it's going to be fantastic. I did notice you have one question going, because going back, not going back super far, back to 2020. I noticed that you did, you were a driver in a movie called Meat Hook Massacre 4 Bloodline. With so you had a small role in that one, and
I did,
that was directed by Jeremiah Douglas.
Yes.
And I became aware of that because I'm a big fan of Dustin Ferguson, and I'm friends with him on Facebook, and I've been trying to get him. The dude is busy, and I've been trying to get him on the show as well sometime. Yes. But that's how I got small family. The connective tissue is there. Like it's very small, it's all there. And was there any kind of inspiration from your experience on that film that kind of went here? Because I've seen Meat Hook Massacre 4. I don't anticipate them being similar, but once you had that kind of like experience, kind of like, huh. And I like what you're going here, because Meat Hook Massacre, it picks up 2 years after a prior event, which I thought was kind of neat.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, our film Meat Hook takes place 2 years after this main event. So So kind of the way that I came up with the story was I was really interested in finding out what happens to a final girl at the end of the slasher film. Now, we've picked up with those characters later on, Sidney Prescott in the Scream films, Laurie Strode, all these other people. But
Ellen Ripley. Alien to Aliens. Yeah.
Yeah. Big time. Alien Trauma. 3. Alien 3, which, you know, we might choose to forget or not, depending on.
I will defend Alien 3 all day long. I will.
I like Alien 3. I mean, Fincher had a lot going against him with that film, and he did the best he could, you know? But I did like Alien 3. I'm very upset that Neil Blomkamp did not get a chance to make his version of the Alien sequel, which would have had Ripley, Hicks, and Newt returning. Also, Mr. Scott's could make Alien Covenant. That's a shame. Hopefully one day that'll happen. I'm not optimistic, but yeah. So I don't know where the hell we got off on it.
You have any hope? You think there's any hope for I don't know if it's been officially announced yet, but the Fede Alvarez for Alvarez's Alien project coming
out. I'm not even familiar with that. No. Oh, wait a minute. Is that supposed to be a TV show or?
I'm not sure if it's going to be a series or what it's going to be, but I just heard Alvarez, yeah. Who I've loved since, you know, Evil Dead. Evil Dead and Don't Breathe. I love that. Predominantly I love how he pretty much just like, you know, to the critics he's unabashed in that. He's willing to do is like, because Don't Breathe, as excellent as that was in direct response to the critics who had problems with Evil Dead. It's like, oh, it was too loud. It's you in your face. Like, okay, well, how about a movie where nobody talks because everybody quiet like that? I love how he did. It's so on point. And
did he also do High Tension, or was that? That was Andre Aja, I think. I think I'm getting Fetty and Aja mixed up. Yeah.
But I'm hoping because, you know, I get like Prometheus and Covenant and this whole like, you know, Jesus-y thing, whatever Scott's going on.
Yeah, whatever the hell he's going for there. I don't know.
Alien Christ, I'm not sure, but yeah. You know, wherever I'm looking forward to new blood, to fresh blood coming in and trying to handle it. I know that Fincher was tough, but you know, I love that he expanded the universe and brought a new tone to it. I loved that. Leterrier, not great. Plus that script by, I'm sorry, Joss Whedon, he's probably, you know, he'll never hear this, but that script was fucking horrible. I'm sorry. It was just awful, but.
Sorry about Resurrection.
Yeah, Alien Resurrection, you know, like it's just, it's not great, but.
It had some problems, yeah.
Yeah, but Alvarez, you know, has a unique style. I'm looking forward to what he may bring to that, so.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of him. I really enjoyed his Evil Dead film. At first, when I saw it, I was very on the fence on whether or not I was a fan of it. I was like, well, where's Ash? Who's this? What's this whole story about this friend trying to get sober? I'm not sure if I'm invested
in the worst place possible.
In the middle of the woods, like we couldn't go out to a retreat in Palm Springs or something. You know, I feel like that would have been better. But anyway, great job that he did on the film, especially when compared to. I'm not sure if you're a fan of Evil Dead Rise, but I felt like Alvarez with the Evil Dead really knocked it out of the park, even better than Rise.
I enjoyed Evil Dead Rise. I dug it. I felt it was the perfect blend of Alvarez's vision and Raimi's vision, where it took the campy black humor that Raimi was, you know, that made Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness so fantastic. Right. But it took like Alvarez's like the real brutality and the horror of what Alvarez it put those two together. I thought it worked well. I love Evil Dead Rise. I saw it in theaters. I don't know why it gets so much hate. Because I dug the shit out of it, but that's just me.
Well, to me personally, I think it felt like an Evil Dead film only in very, very specific parts. Otherwise, it seems just like a very standard possession film. I felt like you could have just had. You didn't have to call it Evil Dead. You take away a couple of elements like the Necronomicon and things like that, and it's just a standard possession film. I felt like it didn't really balance the tone of the comedy, the dark comedy, and the horror very well. Like, we had the gag where the eyeball was spit out somebody's mouth or something like that. That was very Raimi-esque, but I feel only Raimi could really pull that off. And funny story, I was actually an intern over at Ghost House Pictures, which is Sam Raimi's production
company. That's
right. Yeah, I was an intern over there for a short period of time as part of my film degree, and read a lot of scripts, and a great filmmaker, really great guy. I remember just sitting in there one day, I was reading a script doing coverage, and he walks out. He's like, "Hey, I'm Sam Raimi." I'm like, "Fucking no, yes. Hi, how you doing?"
My hi, hero. Nice to meet you. You are. It's like
so. That was great. That was a really great experience. And obviously, Fede Alvarez works a lot with them and Ghost House. Shout out everybody at Ghost House Pictures. For making some great films out there outside of the monopoly of Blumhouse right now, which is kind of dominating the whole horror genre, right, for better or worse, depending on how you look at it. So
I feel it either hits or it misses. It's like one of the two. It's like either it there or not. So yeah, like not there.
Yeah, either you're getting I don't know what the best Blumhouse movie is, but either you're getting that or you're getting Black Christmas remake. You know what I mean? let's not go there. Let's not even try to go there.
We did get a chance. I love that you interned there as well, and you got to meet Raimi and everything. Because on the previous episode of the show, are you familiar with J.K. Bookwalter's The Dead Next Door?
I'm not. No, what's that?
So J.K. Bookwalter was 19 years old when he shot his indie. It was like his epic indie, like zombie horror, and it's essentially
The Dead Next Door. Yes, okay, I know.
Yeah, the one takes place up in Akron, Ohio, and it kind of blew our minds because I'm watching this, and it was when I found out that Sam Raimi executive produced that thing, and Bruce Campbell did like the sound supervision on it as well as a little bit of voiceover. Yeah. But that influence there, I was like, holy shit, this dude is 19 years old. He shot this fucking thing on a Super 8, and I'm kind of like,
man.
And he pulled this off. Like, he got, like, you know, live action, you know, like at the Capitol building, like zombies climbing on the fence in front of the White House. I'm like, how the fuck did he pull this shit off? It's like, oh, Raimi executive producer. That was fucking cool. That, you know, even this was back in 89, because it was 4 years to produce. And, you know, back there in the late 80s when he pulled that off, I thought that was badass. Sam Raimi is so fucking
cool. Yeah, so Sam's a big champion of indie filmmakers. And I think they even had their own series called, like, After Dark Films or something like that, which put out or distributed releases, a lot of foreign releases. But there was a lot of really good movies out there and a lot of really young filmmakers who were up and coming who they were given a chance to. So, yeah, big shout out to Sam and Ghost House Pictures for trying to put some people on. I wish Sam would go back and direct another horror movie, man. I want another Drag Me to Hell.
Drag Me to Hell.
Man, I mean, that's just a return to form for him. You know, I felt like that's Sam at his most purest, you know? The Doctor Strange movies and the Spider-Mans, they're all well and good. But at the end of the day, just give that man a very small budget. And just let them alone and make something fun.
At the end of it, we need weird shit going into people's mouths. That's what we need.
That's what we're craving for, Sam. Please.
No one does it like Raimi does.
Bile, vomits, and anything. Blood, eyeballs coming out. Please give it to us all. Make it slapstick. Make it fun. Make it scary. Let's do it. You know. So yeah, big fan of Sam and all his films. But getting back to Meat Hook, So the genesis behind the story really was trying to tell a story about what happens to a final girl after. That's where we got off the tangent. We were talking about Ripley and all the rest of the final girls. But yeah, I was really interested in what happens after that. And now, obviously, we might meet up with the character after the events of the first film, and they'll have some trauma. I think most specifically, the best example of that is Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, where we see the character of Laurie, Scout Taylor Compton, really going through a difficult time dealing with the events of the first film, which I feel are very natural and a very interesting topic to explore, other than just picking up with them. And it's like, okay, well, now the killer's back. Now they got to defeat him again, you know, which is all well and good. I mean, I love the Scream films, don't get me wrong, but Sydney would have been fucked up after all that shit. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, we pick up with her, you know, what was it, 6 or 5 or whatever, and she's got a kid, everything's good. a lot of other people would have been in an insane asylum. They would have been dealing with some trauma through all 5, 6, 7 different attempts of murder on them. So I really wanted to explore that and see what happens. So we also kind of do some flashbacks in the film where we go back and kind of tell the story of what happened to her a couple of years ago. So Meat Hook is almost like a sequel in and of itself from this earlier story, which we tell of our main protagonist, Jordan, which we tell through flashbacks. So I was really interested in kind of telling a sequel story like that without actually having the first film and just kind of telling it through flashbacks. So that was really fun doing that. And we had a really great cast of actors. Our lead, who plays the main character of Jordan, Renee Leach, she knocked it out the park. She is such an amazing actress. She really carries this film on her back. And I'm not saying that just to boost her self-esteem or anything. She did a fantastic job. And you guys could probably see in the trailer, just the reactions in her eyes from things is just fantastic. And she was able to pull off multi different facets of this character through the trauma that she's dealing with, the sense of loss, and able to overcome that. And by the end of the film, have this really beautiful arc. So was really, really blessed to have an amazing cast of actors working on this film to bring this story to life. And yeah, finally going to get this damn thing out next year. So.
And I love that you went there. To be honest, as a writer, from what I've seen, is that oftentimes studio films trying to dive into deep psychological concepts like that is often very, very difficult. And I love that you brought up the inspiration there with Halloween 2, that Zombie tried to go there as well. I honestly think, while I enjoyed Halloween 2 for what Zombie was trying to do, I don't think he's the guy, unfortunately, to tell that kind of story. That's a little bit more nuanced and deep than I think he as an artist can go. Right. But the idea that violence, you know, permeates and infects others around you and has a domino effect. And I love, because he captured it perfectly with Scout's performances, Lori, with Danielle's performances, Annie, and with Dourif's performances, Sheriff Brackett. All three of them are affected in these different ways, and you can see it in their they got it. Like the whole white horse thing, you know, was a little out there, but
yeah, I get it.
I loved what he was trying to do. I think that David Gordon Green was trying to do the same thing with Halloween Kills, trying to do the exact same thing with the whole Corey thing, but still not quite there. But acknowledging that this is a real thing, acknowledging that it does happen, that it's reflective of a real life, that is such meaty, deep shit that I think people gravitate to it, but it can also be repelling, because it's kind of like it almost hits way too close to home. But that's it's about. That ultimately, I think that's what it's about. That's where we have to go as storytellers.
Exactly. Yeah, and you know, horror is a very interesting genre where we can explore different themes like this, but do it in the wrappings of the genre, so it feels very much like an entertainment. You know, there are entertainment films, but we are trying to come after something a little bit deeper. You know, we are trying to explore the human condition in some ways. We're not just trying to have two-dimensional characters running through and getting slashed up and killed, and by the end, you know, we roll the credits. We're trying to do something a little bit more nuanced than that. And I agree. I do feel like, although Zombie explored a lot of that in Halloween 2, to great success, there were some elements about it which we could have dived in deeper. And you also mentioned about Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends, about that fear permeating. Exploring how that fear has that domino effect. I was really interested in that aspect about the film. I really wanted to explore that even more. I will be quite honest. I hate Ends and Kills so much, JL. And we can have a whole podcast episode about Ends and Kills, about going back and forth on that. I do love 2018. 2018 was fantastic.
2018, was great. Yeah,
I think we can all agree on that. It's once we get the Kills that, you know, the differences of opinion start to show between the horror community and Halloween fans. But you know, they did try something different, and I think at the end of the day, it is just about trying something different out of the norm and exploring topics that give a different depth and meaning to the film. other than just your general typical cliche horror slasher fare. I mean, as filmmakers in the horror genre, we're able to put themes and messages into our films, which can go very underneath the radar. But later on, people like us, fans of the genre, will be able to pick up on them. I mean, we're talking about Night of the Living Dead, you know, we're talking about the consumerism of Dawn of the Dead. We're talking about the militarism of Day of the Dead. You know, there's a lot of things that you could put in, which, you know, on the surface could just wash over, you know, it's a zombie film, you know, but at the end of the day, if you really think about it and you dive in deep, Romero's trying to tell us something here. He's right. Trying to make a statement on society, on consumerism, on the hurting effect of people, you know. David Gordon Green is trying to tell us something as well in these films. Now, whether or not they succeed or not is a totally different story, but just the fact that you try and you make the extra effort to do that, I think really separates the good filmmaker from the great ones.
And I think it's important that everybody try to pick that up and try to run with it, even though they may not be like I said, the outcome I don't think matters. The fact that people need to start trying this. I understand that, like, when you talk about like what they tried to accomplish in Ends, what Green was trying to accomplish in Ends, mm-hmm. I get what he was trying to do. I think he accomplished a little bit better than what Zombie did in Halloween 2. But, you know, and then you look at what Darabont did with The Mist. And, you know, that was, you know, that how fear, like, you know, informs people. It's kind of the same thing. But, you know, certain aspects of storytelling shouldn't be relegated to a handful of individuals in the industry. And I'm always terrified that indie filmmakers will feel like, well, you know, I'm not that good. Like, I'm not Frank Darabont. I can't tell that kind of story. But, you know, people have got to try and got to keep doing that. And so it's not just a handful of people that we have to go to get a certain type of storytelling element.
Exactly. You know, it doesn't need to be a drama in order for it to have a message or to have deep characters which go through obstacles and are able to overcome them in a way that we can relate to in many ways. And one of the reasons why I gave our main character of Jordan this backstory and this arc of dealing with trauma and loss was that right before writing the film, a good friend of mine and a good friend of Russell's as well, who we went to school with over at CSUN, Rick Lozano, he was also the producer on Among the Mistletoe and A Creature is Stirring. He helped out a lot on those films. He passed away before we made Meat Hook, very sudden and tragically. So that was a very difficult loss to take, because Rick was always a big champion of me and my films and just so passionate about filmmaking and storytelling, and such a brilliant editor as well. That trying to go back to filmmaking and have that same drive and passion without somebody kind of, you know, you can do it, man. You can do it. Let's fucking make this shit happen. You know, that kind of producer drive, you know, that somebody who believes in you, who wants to see you succeed, was very, very difficult. So I really wanted to explore the feelings that I was having from that loss of losing a very close friend. So that's why I included that in there. And I think it's things like that that are very personal to us as storytellers and filmmakers that we're able to bring to the story, which really makes it stand out and hopefully other people can relate to and hopefully pick up on the message and help them in some sort of way. I'm hoping that, you know, when people watch this film, they can relate to the main character and her loss and trauma and be able to relate to it and find some sort of strength and solace in the same way that she does to move forward and carry on. You know, we all experience loss and trauma in our lives, and it's really just about how we're able to pick ourselves up and come back from that, which really stands out. So that was really a big deciding factor in wanting to tell this story. And I hope that's something that a lot of people pick up on when they watch it.
There's a little bit of autobiography in every single one of them.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Just like, you know, in your films, in your stories, which you tell, I'm sure that there's a lot of things from your own personal life, which you put in there. And those are experiences which nobody else has. You know, many times we try to maybe mimic or copy more successful stories or filmmakers that we see without really looking deep inside ourselves on what makes us so unique and what makes our story so unique that it's something that we can tell, which maybe nobody else has told before, or at least told it in a specific way that you can.
Right. Damn, freaking cool. I cannot wait to see it. I'm waiting, pins and needles to get that because I love the trailer. And
thank you, man.
Yeah, and I absolutely love what Renee brought to that.
Killed it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just from that, the way she emotes is fucking phenomenal. And I was kind of like, I'm liking her for what she's bringing to the screen without having to say it, what she can show. So I'm looking forward to that. And I love that you went into a challenging area of storytelling because I love people who take risks and people willing to put a piece of themselves out there. I love that notion.
Exactly. Yeah. And it could be very scary, putting a piece of yourself out there. You're very kind of bearing yourself to the world. Here I am. Here's what's on my mind. Here's what I'm thinking about. Here's what I'm going through. And, that's part of just being a storyteller is injecting part of that into there. Renee, she knocked it out of the park. She was a fantastic actress. Keep a lookout for her. She's got a lot of feature films coming up soon. We caught her at just the right time. This lady's going to be blowing up. Please take a look and check out all of Renee's work because fantastic actress right there. Not only that, but the other actors in our film, I don't want to sell them short either. The other lead character and actor that we have in there, Havan Baraka, big fan of horror films. You should have this guy on the podcast. Let me tell you, this guy is the biggest Halloween fan that you will ever meet. When I met him in the audition room, we just hit it off immediately. Just started talking about horror movies and shit, and I knew from the jump, even if I don't hire this guy, I want to be friends with this guy because he's cool peeps. So he did a fantastic job in the film, and he's not only a great actor as well, he's a fantastic writer. This guy has written so many screenplays. He's more of a writer than he is an actor, and he doesn't like to be known as an actor primarily, so he'll be happy that I put that out there. But yeah, he's got a lot of really great projects in the works that he's working on, not only acting but writing as well. So please keep a lookout for Havan Baraka and all the work that he's about to put out there. Me and him are actually working on a screenplay together. We're collaborating on a feature film screenplay that I can't really say too much about right now, but I'm very, very excited to be working with him on that and being able to show his fantastic acting skills in Meat Hook.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool. Now, going forward, Meat Hook's on the horizon, and that's going to drop. Is there anything in particular, like goals wise, you see, now that Meat Hook's going to drop and you've opened up these new doors and everything.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of like personal milestones or goals that you want to, you want to try and get, like anybody you want to work with or any kind of particular story you want to tell?
That's a great question. JL, I don't have any particular people. I mean, I'd love to work with everybody. There's a lot of really great up and coming filmmakers and actors out there who aren't famous, who are doing fantastic work and nobody's seeing it because their name isn't Carpenter or Craven or Roth or something like that, but they're doing fantastic work. So I forgot your question. I'm sorry. I got lost on a little tangent.
If there was anybody to work with. Anybody you really hope to work with one day. Just kind of for me, I mean, of all the people out there, one actor I love and I think is desperately underserved is Nick D'Amici. I am a huge fan of Nick D'Amici.
That's very familiar. What has he been in before?
Okay, so Stakeland and Stakeland 2. And I first saw him in the After Dark Horror Fest entry, Mulberry Street.
Oh yeah.
And then he did this movie called Late Phases, which was him and Ethan Embry. And in Late Phases, he plays a blind Vietnam veteran who's who gets moved into a retirement home. And his son is played by Ethan Embry. And it's a werewolf film. So it's this blind Vietnam, no-nonsense Vietnam veteran who finds out that there's a werewolf preying upon the local community of geriatrics.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And that movie is fucking amazing.
That sounds fun. What was the name of that one again?
It's called Late Phases.
Late Phases. Okay, I'm going to have to check that one out. That sounds good.
So, and I felt like I just love Nick D'Amici's work. He's fantastic. He's a born New Yorker, and he's got this kind of attitude and this presence that he brings to the screen.
Yeah.
And I want to work with him. Like one day, I actually, for one of the films that I wrote, I have a part specifically made for that man. I hope we can catch him one time.
Hell yeah. Get him. Yeah.
Anybody like that for you?
Nobody in particular off the top of my head. That's a great question. I wish I would have had a better answer for that, but I really don't. In terms of milestones, though, definitely getting a feature film under my belt was one of them. So now that we're kind of passing that milestone, the next thing is to make the next one. You know, I want to make the next one. So I'm currently working on a few different outlines for the next feature film script. It's definitely going to be more comedic leaning, although it's still in the realm of horror. But currently, but before I get to that, I was just recently hired to write a feature film screenplay for something. It's a horror film as well, and it's going to be hopefully shot a little bit later next year. I think we're looking at summertime for that. I can't give out a whole lot of details about that, but it is a very fun film, similar in vein to, I would say, Chopping Mall, if you're familiar with that. Yeah,
I prefer the alternate title, Killbots. I think that I think it was a far. That's one thing. It's one hill I'll die on. It's like Chopping Mall. Is just, I get it. Chopping Mall is like,
of course.
I prefer Killbots. I love that one. It's like, plus, you know, like zap, you know, Barbara Crampton. I fucking love that.
Yeah,
shit.
No, it makes more sense in terms of a better title. Yeah, I see why they went Chopping Mall to kind of reel people into the theater, but Killbots is a little bit more fitting for the film for sure. I agree. Classic. Nice. Love me some Chopping Mall.
Fuck yes. I remember catching that one. Oh, man, I was still living in Texas, and I think I was like 10 or 11 years old, and I caught that one on, like, because there's this one TV station that did a horror movie like in the middle of the afternoon and then one at late at night. Nice. And I can't even remember what station it was on. I just remember we had the brown cable box and people like this. So,
the brown cable box. I remember that.
And it was whatever station was playing A Current Affair, like that old show, A Current Affair, was on.
Yeah,
so it was that same one.
Kind of show. Yeah.
Right. And so I was like, it was that station. And they always have, that's how I saw like Happy Birthday to Me. And
nice.
Yeah. So I caught a whole bunch of shit that was like the first time you pop it on and you're just like, oh, what I'm like 11 years old. I was like, what is this movie?
Yeah.
And then someone gets skewered through the mouth of the fucking shish kebab. And you're like,
man,
that leaves a mark, leaves an indention.
Fucking core memories right there. Shout out the programmers for all these local TV stations in the 80s and 90s. And even now, who are just introducing whole new generations of people to these classic films. So many great films I caught on TV younger too. I don't know who the hell was putting them on. I don't know who the hell was programming them, but God bless those people because they're doing a great job. I don't know if you're a big fan of Joe Bob and The Last Drive-In, but I know he showed Chopping Mall on there a while back, and that was really great. I'm a big Joe Bob fan. I don't know if you watched it in the Monster Vision days when it was on TNT.
Oh, but no, I didn't back in those days. I hadn't really caught on to it now. Everything is like I'm going back and watching it now. So,
oh, man. Yeah, those are classic. Yeah, another great programmer right there. Joe Bob Briggs, TNT. Saw a lot of fantastic B-grade, low-budget films on there, which have stuck with me for the rest of my life. So, you know, it's just discovering those things, you know, which is the joy.
And to give a bit of a shout out, our last guest who was on for our row, Sean Heights, his recent production is Cannibal Comedian. And Cannibal Comedian just cleaned up at Joe Bob's festival that he did. Yeah, so it just took that home. I was like, that was badass. I'm looking forward to when that comes out.
Oh, hell yeah.
So Cannibal Comedian looks, the trailer will catch you. It's fucking awesome. So.
Cannibal Comedian. Okay, I'm going to check that out. And I'm hoping that we can bring Meat Hook to the Jamboree whenever they have it next year well. Hopefully win some awards. So yeah, we're going to go the festival route with Meat Hook first. We're going to start releasing it and submitting it to different festivals. Definitely a lot of horror and genre specific festivals before we find a distributor and put the thing out. So yeah, JL, I'm really excited for you to see this thing. I'll definitely keep you posted. I'm hoping we're gonna have some screenings out in your area as well, so I'll keep you posted about that. Yeah, I'm really excited for everybody to see this film and finally put this thing out there. I hope people enjoy it. Like you said earlier on the podcast today, you were talking about you watch films in a certain context now that you're a filmmaker, knowing how much work goes into it. And I feel like once you get into this field and you see that, it's kind of hard to put some movies down, just knowing how much time and effort people spent on putting into this thing, whether it's good, whether or not it's bad. Somebody rolled the dice, they took a gamble, they put their heart on their sleeve, and they went out there and they made a movie. And that's what following your dream and passion is all about. So anybody who out there, you know, who's thinking, oh, money's stopping me, a lack of actors is stopping me, a lack of locations, whatever, you can make it work. You can make it happen. And just go out there and do it. Sometimes it just takes that drive and that gumption and just throw yourself head first into the process, and you'll come out at the end of it some way, you know, and hopefully be a better storyteller and filmmaker at the end of it as well. And hopefully have a good product. And if you don't, then fuck it, make another one, you know, and then make another one until you're good at it, you know, and that's what you got to do. So, so hopefully we knock it out the park this time around, first time around with Meat Hook. Hopefully a lot of people enjoy it. Hopefully it becomes successful. And we can get some money for, you know, the next one. We don't have to, beg people on a crowdfunding to give us money going full circle.
We don't have to sell ourselves in order to make a movie.
Please, Jesus, give me $5 so I can afford some catering, you know? No, we don't want to.
You know, it's fantastic advice that you just gave there. The very first guest we ever had on this show was a director named Matthew Mark Hunter. And Matthew was you know, he was getting into it when we had him on the show. He'd already shot over 100 short films, and we're talking tiny little shoestring budget, almost no budget stuff that we're talking like puppets and, you know, whatever he could, just honing his craft and getting down to style. Now the fucker's working for Troma. Wow. So, which he segued into that, but I think he's like 200 short films under his belt, and of just all kinds of wacky shit that you could possibly throw on camera, just whatever you can. And now he segued that. Now he's doing some, you know, excellent work with Lloyd Kaufman and a number of other individuals. His star is going to blow up once he gets going. So
And he took a page from Raimi said at a convention, which is a very popular video that goes around, is just make a short film every weekend. Go out with your friends, take whatever means and resources you have, make it, edit it, put it out there, and then next week you can go make another one until you got, you know, like this guy does, he's got 100 of them. That's all experience, that's all on set experience that he has firsthand making these things. You know, this isn't theory. This isn't sitting down reading a book, watching a YouTube video. This is hands-on getting out there and putting shit out and making stuff. So big respect to that guy. Big props for him for making that happen and put it out there. And anybody else out there, you know, you can do the same thing. You don't need a whole lot of money in order to make a short film. You don't need actors who have, you know, Academy Awards or famous. Just get out there, hone your craft. Learn framing, learn how to talk to actors, learn how to pace a film, learn how to edit, you know, just figure these things out and have fun at it as you go along. You know, we're in a very fun genre right here with a lot of very supportive people in the community, you know, who are willing to go out there and just watch, you know, a movie they've never heard of with no big stars in it, just for the fact, oh, it's called Meat Hook? Look at that. He's got a hook. He's killing people. Count me in. Let's see what it's all about. You know, I might like it, I might not, but I'm going to give it a shot because I love horror and this is my bread and butter, you know? So
I love that poster for Meat Hook. That almost like Dead Calm vibe it's got going on there. It's like,
Dead Calm.
I fucking love that. I'm a big fan of minimalism. You've got the red tone, you got the eyes there, you got the hook, and then Meat Hook. That's all you fucking need to know. It's like, that's what you got going forward. I was like, I love that. I love the, you know, just minimalism just gets me. It's just like,
I feel it. Yeah, you don't got to go full crazy and just populate, you know, with every little idea that you got. Keep it simple. So yeah, big shout out to Alex Ivic. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. For creating the poster, you guys can check it out on our Instagram, Facebook page. We also have him tagged in it as well, in case you guys want to check out some of his other work, or if you want to commission him for any posters that you guys are putting together later on. Check it out.
I mean, we have to do that because we've got some stuff coming up. So we may have to. We may talk a little bit after this.
Let me know. Totally.
Well, this has been absolutely amazing Jeremy, thank you so much for sitting down with us and having a chat. This has been an absolute
pleasure. Night with you, JL. We can go on and on about this thing, but we'll save that for another time.
I apologize for myself. I tend to kind of like, he was like, oh yeah, let's talk about this. I tend to kind of like branch
off.
No,
I love that. That's what it's all about. This is organic. This is a conversation. You know, this isn't the Tonight Show, you know, where we're sticking to a little formula. You know, we're having fun out here. No, this is good. I love your enthusiasm. I love your knowledge of horror films. I just love talking movies, man. You know, that's why we came into this thing. We love movies. Let's talk.
That's what it's fucking about. Absolutely.
Big time.
Well, thank you so much. And to all of you listening out there, we've had this amazing opportunity to sit down with Jeremy Ashley and talk about his upcoming feature, Meat Hook, as well as his fantastic career and all of the amazing experiences he's had and some fantastic advice. So for all of you listening out there, definitely, I hope you dug this. And of course, if you want to get early access to things like this, to things like Front Row, where we sit down with the professionals that make this genre the one we love so much, you can support us at Patreon and get early access. Literally, it's like $3 a month. So definitely check that out. And you can hear all these fantastic tales that we have told and all the people that we talk to and get all that early access. So thank you for support. Otherwise, we're going to see you when this drops a little bit later on. So I hope you all enjoyed it. Thank you once again, Jeremy. We do appreciate you coming out, taking time out of your schedule.
Thank you, Joanne.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you so much for listening. I have been JL. This has been another edition of the Week in Horror Front Row with our special guest, Jeremy Ashley. We hope you all enjoyed it. We will see you all next month. And as always, stay scared.
Stay scared.